This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen, coming to you Tuesday, September 7th, 2004. On Friday, August 27th, CBS came forward with what Leslie Stahl considered shocking news. And they said, FBI probes Pentagon spy case. On CBS.com, CBS News has learned that the FBI has a full-fledged espionage investigation underway and is about to, in FBI terminology, roll up someone agents believe has been spying not for an enemy, but for Israel, from within the office of the Secretary of Defense at the Pentagon. The FBI investigation, headed up by David Sadzi, had involved wiretaps, undercover surveillance, and photography that CBS News was told document the passing of classified information from the mole to the men at AIPAC and on to the Israelis. Within a day, the press had released the name of the so-called mole, Larry Franklin. And, again, the release soon was that, as the Washington Post exposed, this investigation had been going on not for a week, not for a month, but for almost 2 years. And National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice knew full well the details of this investigation. What does this mean? Was it another Pollard case? Of a deep mole and Israeli spying on the United States? Soon the story was revealed. Ralph?
Well, in fact, what we have here with respect to the Franklin case is the claim that this is somehow a unique and distinct situation when, in fact, Franklin has been stated to be a conduit for passing information to AIPAC, which is the main Zionist lobby in the United States, reflecting essentially Israeli policy, and the documents that were being passed to AIPAC pertaining to Iran and pertaining to U.S. plans for Iran, of course, were immediately transferred to the Mossad and Israeli intelligence. As if, however, as I mentioned, this was somehow a distinct affair. In truth, AIPAC, the ADL, the Zionist organizations in the United States have always performed this role. In fact, in a rather instructive article in Counterpunch by Stephen Green, Bush Neocons in Israel, with regard to the example of Dr. Stephen Byron and colleagues, the pattern over a period of decades of the de facto spying or transfer of intelligence information to the Israeli state is shown to be a constant procedure. In fact, Byron was caught red-handed in a process of taking classified documents to the Israeli state, and he then becomes a key figure with Pearl in all of the instruments of the Defense Policy Board and the neocon decision-making. It's part of the process through which the integration of the Zionist state's imperial design in the Middle East is linked inexorably to American imperial plans themselves.
Today on Taking Aim, from calamity to conflagration, the pending attack on Iran. President Bush's National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice and her top deputy Stephen Hadley were informed of the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee probe not long after Bush took office in 2001, according to administration officials, wrote the Wall Street Journal on September 3rd. The briefing, which was probably 2 years ago, involved the focus on Larry Franklin, who's the Pentagon analyst specializing on Iran and the Middle East affairs in the Office of Policy, Undersecretary Douglas Feith. It is in this very office, the Office of Douglas Feith, that the disinformation about Iraq, which became the basis for Vice President Dick Cheney, President Bush, and the proclamations of Donald Rumsfeld, and most particularly the presentation of Secretary of State Colin Powell before the United Nations, the documentation about weapons of mass destruction and the imminent of nuclear development in Iraq, as well as the disinformation about the Iraqi relationship with Al-Qaeda, the very basis for the U.S. attack, invasion, occupation of Iraq. This disinformation came from the office of Undersecretary Douglas Feith. And Larry Franklin, a Pentagon analyst specializing on Iran and the Middle East, was one of the people developing this disinformation. Ralph?
Well, we're talking here not about the basis for an attack on Iraq, but the pretext for an attack
on
Iraq.
Correct, the pretext.
And what we have here is the continuation of a major policy that was established in the late 1970s. We've often discussed it. It appears in detail in the book that I wrote called The Hidden History of Zionism, a detailed plan set forth by Oded Yinon, prepared in the late 70s, formally published in 1982, which called for a strategy of permanent and preemptive war to fragment and break up each Middle Eastern country into its ethnic and religious components, and to contrive a rationale or pretext or justification for carrying out this policy, the underlying purpose of which was to destroy the national movement for independence and the anti-imperial impulse of the Arab masses who aspire to controlling their own resources, and to secure direct military control of the oil of the region. Oded Yinon's strategy for the 80s is a perfect elaboration of the necessity to provide a new rationale for permanent war, and particularly aimed at the oil-producing areas of the Middle East and Central Asia, and to do so on the basis of the category of terror, an ideological construct quite cynically set forth as the necessary replacement for the communist menace as a rationale for permanent military preparation and war. It is a reflection of the fact, as we've said so often on Taking Aim, that this is an economic and political system in terminal crisis, compelled to pursue adventurous wars requiring the total subjugation of populations and direct theft of their resources, with the almost absurd assumption that somehow the populations in question will acquiesce in permanent occupation, permanent brutalization, the talk about weapons of mass destruction, the preparation of effectively tactical nuclear weapons, radiological weapons indeed, that have permeated Iraq, are aimed now at Iran. The Franklin affair, the spy affair concerning Franklin, the surfacing of this conduit for passing information to the Mossad through APEC, something that's been done on a constant and continuous and structured basis for the past, how many years, since 1948, if truth be told, but certainly with an intensity since the 70s. This is but a reflection of the crisis of this system, because sectors of our rulers know perfectly well the consequence of the drumbeat for an attack on Iran, which is in the offing, and about which the Franklin affair is a central piece.
Let's look at the timing. The FBI agents, on Friday, the very day of the release, the leak to CBS, had gone to the offices of the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, APAC, to take the computer hard drive of a senior staffer, Steve Rosen, who was APAC's director of foreign policy. And, as we mentioned, this was the date of this had been a delay because this investigation had been going on for almost 2 years, and yet the FBI was sluggish, was not really investigating. Why now? As soon as this was released, immediately you had, coming from both the houses of the Congress, the Senate and the House of Representatives, the speakers coming forward with their support of APEC. As House Majority Whip Roy Blunt of Missouri said, APEC has worked hard to build its credibility with members of Congress on both sides of the aisle. While the House will want to look carefully at any allegations that might endanger our national security, it begins with the record of great confidence in our relationship with APEC and our strongest ally and the only democracy in the Middle East. Israel. And the House Democratic Whip, Stanley Hoyer, a Democrat from Maryland, also expressed his confidence in AIPAC. I have worked with AIPAC for many years. They are a very successful, strong, and committed organization and do a tremendous job advocating for the important U.S.-Israel relationship. All these mouthings confirmed what took place in May when President George Bush appeared before the AIPAC Annual Convention, the largest convention in the AIPAC history, which included 5,000 people, many of them members of Congress, demonstrating once again the close relationship between Congress and not just AIPAC, but the Israeli state. Ralph?
Well, AIPAC is essentially presented as a lobbying organization, solicits and arranges the virtual purchase of members of Congress. They allocate bags of cash and contributions to every congressional figure, to both political parties, notably the Democratic Party, let it be pointed out. But it is a cash cow, and it is more than a cash cow. It is a repository of operatives who function for the Israeli state and the Mossad, in conjunction with American imperialism, but wherever it is necessary for the Israeli state to take adventurous measures of its own and to prevent imperialism from balancing the tactical and strategic role of Israel with the overarching needs of the imperial control of the region itself, the Zionists use this spy apparatus to secure the necessary information, and when they've been caught at it, they're promoted. Almost the Pollard case is a rare exception in this instance, because normally the spying which is congruent with the policies of imperialism is not just covered up, but sanctioned.
Ralph, AIPAC was considered by Fortune magazine a couple of years ago when it did a study of lobbying groups. AIPAC was considered the fourth most powerful lobbying group in the United States, much more powerful than the AFL-CIO, the House of Labor, and the American Medical Association. So AIPAC is right up there. Now, let's look not just at the lobbying, but what it means. What is the transfer of information? And much of that has to do with the transfer of military equipment. In fact, the relationship between Israel and the United States in the military-industrial complex are like sister and brother.
Well, I just want to say, Maya, it's not really, I think, appropriate to make a comparison between an apparatus like AIPAC and either the American Medical Association, let alone a class-based institution like the AFL-CIO, which is rooted in labor. Because AIPAC is a money distribution system that's linked to the Israeli state and to its intelligence apparatus, but it's integral to the Defense Intelligence Agency and to the most covert of the intelligence services of the United States government. It is not just lobbying. It is part of policy making for the national security state, and it's the conjuncture. So in that respect, these other organizations do not bear the same relationship to the operation of the national security state as an integral element like AIPAC does. I think, and you're quite right to say here, that what this really bears upon is the question of how they're going to implement their next forward strategy for their war on Iran, which they're debating in terms of only tactics, and we're going to discuss that now.
Israel has long spied on the U.S., say officials, was an article in the Los Angeles Times, September 3rd, by Bob Drogan and Greg Miller. Despite its fervent denials, as Ralph has mentioned, the LA Times also concludes, Israel maintains a large and active intelligence gathering operation in the United States that has long attempted to recruit U.S. officials as spies to procure classified documents, U.S. officials said. But the Israelis themselves say that there is no reason for them to spy in the United States. And after the Pollard affair, they made a policy not to do so. Of course, as we know, with the events of 9/11 and the disclosure of the so-called student apparatus in the United States, students who were then deported, the Israelis have a very large network of spies. But what the Israeli government says is it doesn't need to spy on U.S. Intelligence gathering in the United States, because the Mossad and the CIA, as well as the Israeli Israeli defense intelligence apparatus connected with the military, which is independent of the Mossad, and the U.S. Defense Intelligence Agency, and also the meetings between the members of Congress and the Israeli officials and diplomats. This is long-standing. Whether it's in coffee shops or in their very offices, the Israelis have a very close relationship and do not need to spy. Yet, as has been released by the FBI and other intelligence agencies, the Israelis do have a very vast spy network here in the United States. Enough is not enough for the Israelis.
Well, it has to do with this. Yes, they're integral to the passing of military and intelligence information and the assassination squads and the death squads and the operation of the imperial control through the elimination of opposition, the murder of public figures, and the installation of regimes by coup d'etat. Mossad, integral to all of that, all that intelligence shared and part of a common operation. But when it comes to a plan to take out Tehran, to bomb their nuclear power plants, to do something that that immediately involves American imperialism willy-nilly, regardless of whether that is the strategy of the moment, the tactic of the moment for the national state, the security apparatus in the U.S., the Zionists go forth on their own. And when it comes, as you mentioned, Maya, to a 9/11, the Israeli spy apparatus monitored every single putative hijacker and was in contact with Mohammed Atta and al-Shihi and al-Ghamdi on a constant basis, and their so-called art students pervaded the United States. They have an ongoing, talk about sleeper cells, constant apparatus of skullduggery, false flag operations, staging of provocations which can be imputed to Arabs or other targets of American imperial ambition. Look at the Washington Times on September 2nd. Israel group in FBI robe wields wide influence in the United States. The American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, APEC, the focus now of an FBI investigation about classified government information being given to Israel, has a mission of stopping Iran from acquiring nuclear weapons. Above all, this 65,000-member APEC, founded in the 1950s, ensures through active, well-financed lobbying on Capitol Hill and the White House that Israel's will is to be imposed, and it is strong enough to meet any challenge. APEC is the most important organization affecting U.S. policy, and in specific terms, it's the relationship with Israel. It has consistently ranked America's most powerful special interest group. It has been directly responsible for over 100 legislative initiatives last year, and procuring $5 billion in funds directly to Israel's security apparatus. The FBI probe, Pentagon and State Department officials, including Pentagon Undersecretary for Policy Douglas J. Fife, have been interviewed and briefed by agents determining whether the Pentagon analysts passed classified materials on. But it is clear that APEC takes the view that Iran will develop nuclear, biological, chemical weapons and missiles to deliver them within a few years, and is determined that Congress and the White House will expand U.S. military strategic cooperation to deal directly with Iran. And that's what we're really talking about here, permanent spy apparatus, the actual infiltration and domination and control of key sectors, Defense Intelligence Agency, the neocon apparatus of Defense Policy Board of Richard Perle and Wolfowitz, and the JINSA apparatus and Paul Bremer and James Woolsey, the permanent preemptive war of World War IV, sector now of the ruling class, which are really operatives for the Likud and the Mossad and the Israeli state.
Ralph, a former senior U.S. intelligence officer who's worked closely with Israeli intelligence, stated to the Los Angeles Times that Israel probably gets 90% of everything they want handed to them on a weekly basis. They're treated as very active allies. The relationship with the Israeli intelligence, he remarked, is as intimate as it gets. What's at issue in the Franklin case, and and the FBI investigation of AIPAC has to do with the National Security Directive that's issued by the president about countries, and in this case, particularly, it is Iran. Although Bush has been in office 3.5, almost 4 years now, he has not issued a directive on Iran, and this has been in preparation. And the at issue is whether the U.S. directly puts in the directive regime change, and regime change has been the overriding issue for Douglas Feith, for Richard Perl, for Wormser, and the neocons. As a result, although some of the press is putting Franklin forward as just a policy wonk, a man who has piles of paper, mounds of paper, so many mounds of paper that they, in some of the articles, they portray the intelligence agencies as, Defense Department agencies as putting him in a corner of the room, and where he just uses a computer for putting notes on, as if he's just a mild-mannered policy wonk. But in fact, if you go to articles that such as that appeared in the Washington Monthly, it's September 2004 issue, and the title of the article is Iran-Contra 2, with a question mark, Fresh Scrutiny on a Rogue Pentagon Operation, who Franklin is and his relationship to Feith and U.S. policy towards Iran, or shaping U.S. policy towards Iran, is revealed in much more detail. In fact, Larry Franklin, along with Harold Rode, another Middle East expert in the Department of Defense in Douglas Feith's arena, attended a meeting in Rome in 2001. In fact, in December of 2001, after the events of 9/11, and this meeting was shaped, was promoted and organized by Michael Ledeen. Michael Ledeen, also a well-known neocon, a conservative writer, part of that entire American Enterprise network. The meeting was with Gorbanifar.
Manusher Gorbanifar.
Manusher Gorbanifar of Iran-Contra fame, the arms dealer, and a number of other Iranians. And these were Iranians who were connected to the Iranian government. But it's interesting to note that also attending this meeting was the head of Italy's military intelligence agency, the SISMI, and the Italian Minister of Defense, Antonio Martino, who was very well known in the neoconservative circles, according to the Washington Monthly. Now, this was not a lone meeting. The purpose of the meeting was to consider relations with Iran, and if it was possible to have a large-scale dissident group within Iran to foment so-called regime change, the term that they use for the overthrow, the destruction of the governments of nations throughout the world. And this was not the only meeting. This meeting that took place was the first of several meetings, and then meetings that Ledeen had on his own. And as Gorbanifar later stated, they were faxing back and forth and telephone calls back and forth 6 or 7 times a week until June 2003.
Well, Maya, you're talking here about a particular study in the Washington Monthly by Joshua, Micah Marshall, Laura Rosen, and Paul Glastry's Iran-Contra 2, Fresh Scrutiny on a Rogue Pentagon Operation. And what's important about this article, as you indicate, is that it shows us that with the outing, if you like, of Franklin, what they're not doing, because they cut it off at the pass, is showing us this goes back to the 1979-1980 Iran-Contra operations with Gorbanichar and the efforts to provide a permanent apparatus to control the situation in Iran, and if any government of disfavor were to be installed through struggle and revolution, to create the murder apparatus and terrorist apparatus and assassin apparatus throughout Iran to remove it and to overthrow it. Meetings, plans, involving the very figures now, Franklin and Rhode and Michael Ledeen and David Feith, the continuity. When they were not in the regime, as it were, Feith didn't have a formal position at that time, they were nonetheless carrying out these functions for the intelligence agencies. And that, I think, is what really has to be made clear, brothers and sisters, that you're talking about a permanent murder apparatus for overthrowing regimes and for preparing wars that have extraordinary consequences. Here is the Jewish Forward, an important article by Mark Perlman on September 5th. The Franklin Affair may slow the push for regime change in Tehran. The key Pentagon supporter of the policy of removing the regime in Tehran, Lawrence Franklin, is under investigation for passing classified information to Israel through officials of the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee. News of the FBI probe comes as the administration is reevaluating its policy towards Iraq because of some of the consequences of countenancing a planned preemptive strike against Iraq's nuclear power facilities. And that article in the foreword makes clear that this is the outing of Franklin, an attempt to throw some monkey wrench into the plans for direct attack on Iran and to slow it down a little bit while they consider whether to actually facilitate a, quote, regime change as opposed to a direct military strike. I think there are various investigations that have to be conducted here, the article continues, exploring the possibility that there will be a breathing space for regime change as opposed to direct military action. Franklin is part of, the article continues, of a team of hawks in the Pentagon who clash regularly with State Department officials over Iran policy, leading to what both advocates of engagement and hardliners agree is a deadlock. While the hawks were gaining traction before the Iraq War, their efforts began to fizzle in the spring of 2003 when the situation in Iraq worsened. So here we have the parameters of the debate. And I think it, by the way, is important that we understand this when we talk about Kerry or Bush, because Kerry tries to outflank Bush from the right, calling for preemptive strike, having his brother Cameron visit Ariel Sharon to declare that Bush isn't strong enough in supporting Sharon, and declaring that Kerry supports the right of Israel for preemptive strike against Syria and Iran. You see, it's not a question of Democrat or Republican here. These are tactical questions of the imperial apparatus that crosses, that cuts across so-called party lines. Here's Haaretz. In its article, the Franklin Affair has been spotted on its way to the archives. What if the friend of my friend is my enemy? Undersecretary Douglas Feith speaks with Israelis who come to visit him, and they make common plans. The fact that his underling disclosed some of these plans should not be of particular note, claims the Israeli newspaper. But then he states that when asked by CBS for Israel's reaction to the Franklin story, they stated that that they were unaware that exactly a year before, the same kind of inquiry and investigation had been made. In fact, it's 2 years on this investigation of the practice of passing every plan of the American policymakers directly to the Israeli state had been under inquiry. The Israeli delegation to the United Nations was an element in these operations as well. We're told here by Amir Oren in Haaretz on September 5th. And indeed, in Haaretz, there's a further article by Akiva Eldar called Making a Mountain into a Molehill. In fact, what they're talking about is that this Franklin disclosure is only attempts to minimize the extent to which the effective spying is a permanent part of the role of the neocons and of this apparatus in the American intelligence establishment.
Yes, the American intelligence establishment. As Michael Maloof, a former Pentagon analyst who also worked in the special intelligence unit created by Mr. Feith, by Douglas Feith, the Office of the Office of Special Plans, he said that he believed that Franklin was being targeted. Quote, they are picking us off one by one. We'll be right back after this station ID.
Malachi McCourt, and this is WBAI listener-sponsored radio in New York City.
This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. We continue today with From Calamity to Conflagration, the pending attack on Iran. As I mentioned, the neocons are saying they're being picked off one by one. But in fact, are they being picked off? What they are trying to do, as Ralph has been discussing, is to shape the policy towards Iran, regime change or direct assault. A book written by Richard Perl, the former Assistant Secretary of Defense, and David Frum, An End to Evil, How to Win the War on Terror, was published by Random House in 2003. And in it, they explicitly state what they consider should be U.S. policy towards Iran. They write, quote, Iran wants a lot more than blackmail from us and so poses a much larger danger than North Korea, another country that they had discussed in here, because these are the men who promote the concept of the axis of evil. The mullahs of Iran are sheltering part of the surviving leadership of Al-Qaeda. They created and supported Hezbollah, the terror group that killed almost 300 American soldiers and civilians in Lebanon and Spain in 1983 and 1984. Iran, they go on to say, almost certainly directed the murder of Iraq's most prominent pro-American Shiite cleric, Abdulmajid al-Khoury, within days of his return from 12 years of exile to his home in Najaf. As well, they assassinated Ali Akbar Tabatabai, leader of the Iran Freedom Foundation and a prominent critic of the Khomeini regime. He was assassinated at his home in Bethesda, Maryland, and the Iranians have been sheltering the assassin in Iran to this day. What does Richard Perl, David Frum, and through them, Paul Wolfowitz and Douglas Feith, what is their basis for dealing with Iran? They state explicitly, the mullahs are pursuing a bomb. Our idea of common sense is to stop them. On the basis of our present information, we are not going to stop them by bombing their nuclear facilities. Now, the bombing of the nuclear facilities is the method of choice of the Israelis, and we'll discuss that further on. But for the American neocons, they write, the problem is the terrorist regime that seeks the weapons. The regime must go, and must go is their strategy, and they go into great detail in here about what the United States should do, and it is exactly this policy that Larry Franklin was promoting, and with his meetings with Ghorbanifar and in the office, the Defense Department office. And this is to provide communications equipment and funding and computers and to pay people within Iran who would be part of the movement to overthrow the government.
A web of intrigue, says Time magazine on September 5th. And here they not only link what we've been discussing with Ghorbanifar going back 20 years, but the particular figure in Larry Franklin is an analyst for the Defense Department who had spent the last decade working with Ahmad Chalabi's Iraqi National Congress. Now, that is instructive because Chalabi had been the particular contact for the neocons and the Mossad apparatus who provided all these fabricated reports about weapons of mass destruction and so-called in the hands of Saddam Hussein, biological weapons and chemical weapons and nuclear dirty bomb weapons that were the lying rationale for the invasion of Iraq. And now they're hanging out Chalabi to dry because he had a relationship with the Iranian regime and was attempting to facilitate regime change in Iran on behalf of the Israelis in part, only to be called out by sectors of American imperialism because he was not cooperating with plans for a direct military strike on Iran.
In fact, Ralph, the newspapers report that since Franklin was caught by the FBI, he has been working with the FBI and calling members of the INC with staged pretext statements that have been crafted by the FBI in order to entrap members of the INC to prove that Chalabi was involved in disclosing information to Iran.
Well, now let's look at what this is really. We've teased and we've played with what this really underlies. Let's look at it directly. Here's an important article by Charles Krauthammer in the Washington Post on July 23rd called Axis of Evil, Part 2. Now, Krauthammer is, in fact, a hired voice or hand in the media for the agenda of the Israeli apparatus, the Likud, in the centers of policymaking now, partly through JINSA and the American Enterprise Institute, but the Defense Policy Board of Perl, Richard Perl, and of Paul Wolfowitz. Did we invade the wrong country? One of the lessons being drawn from the September 11th report is that Iran is the real threat. Iran is linked to al-Qaeda. Iran allowed the September 11th hijackers to transit. Iran is harboring al-Qaeda's leaders. The Iraq war critics have a new line of attack. We should have done Iran instead of Iraq. Iran is the threat and the danger. Iran is a serious country with a serious army. Compared with the Iraqi war, an invasion of Iran will be infinitely more costly. If not now, then when? If not war, then what? What happens to be exactly what we've been doing regarding Iran is that we are following a policy that is an abject failure. The Bush administration, having decided that invading one axis of evil country was as much as the military of the country could bear, has gone multilateral on us in Iran. And the result? They've been led by the nose. Iran is caught red-handed with illegally enriched uranium, and the Tehran Three prevail upon the Bush administration to do nothing while they persuade the mullahs to act nice.
Ralph, the Tehran Three are Britain, France, and Germany. These countries have sent representatives to meet with the Iranians and to so-called shut down their nuclear program. And what Krauthammer is setting up is that multilateralism, diplomacy, which John Kerry and the Democrats have so-called put as an alternative. In fact, they don't. John Kerry is explicit about the need for attack, preemptive attack.
Yes, he stated and explicitly, as you say, on point here, Maya, a preemptive attack is what he would support and what he would advocate. And he was specific, as was his brother Cameron, in saying that preemptive strikes aimed at Iran, as Ariel Sharon is preparing, are something that Bush has not been quick enough to support. Kerry and his brother Cameron are in our faces in saying they are calling for a backing of Sharon's plan for a preemptive strike on Tehran.
But what's very interesting about this Krauthammer opinion piece, and I suggest everyone read it in full in the detail, is setting up once again the disinformation. For instance, that Iran is caught red-handed with illegally enriched uranium. Iran has not been caught with any illegally enriched uranium. All this has been investigated by the IAEA and has been shown to be false information, just as the Niger claim of the uranium cake for Iraq was false information, and that was based on forged documents. The main point about Krauthammer is what he writes. He says, the single most urgent issue of our time, rogue states in pursuit of weapons of mass destruction. And who are these rogue states? He states explicitly, there today would be today two major Islamic countries sitting on an ocean of oil, supporting terrorism and seeking the weapons of mass destruction instead of one had we not attacked Iraq. So right here, his basic premise, the sitting on the ocean of oil, that the Islamic countries are the problem, that inevitably they are building weapons of mass destruction, and that they are going to use this in a vast terror apparatus against the people of the United States. There is no choice, according to Kratom, according to Richard Pearl, according to Paul Wolfowitz, according to David Wormser, according to Douglas Fife, according to Dick Cheney and Douglas Rumsfeld, and according to
Donald Rumsfeld,
there is no choice but going into Iran.
Which makes, he adds, the question of preemptive attack all the more urgent. Iran will go nuclear during the next presidential term. Americans think that the Israelis will do the dirty work for us, as in 1981 when they destroyed Saddam Hussein's nuclear reactor. But Iran is a far more difficult proposition. It is further away, whether moreover detection and anti-aircraft technology are more advanced than they were 20 years ago. All that stands between us and disaster is either an overthrow or preemptive strike in Iran. And that theme is well orchestrated, not only by Krauthammer, but widely. Now, here we have in the American Conservative...
Before you do the American Conservative, Ralph, let's note that Richard Pearl, close associate of Krauthammer, when the book The End, An End to Evil was published in 2003, some time ago, Richard Pearl was willing to say that a direct strike on Iran was not the feasible option and that we should look towards the internal regime change. Now you can see the shift that even the neocons have noticed, that this is not going to wash, and they are now pushing for direct strike, setting up the stage for probably an Israeli attack on the nuclear facilities.
Well, the Israelis have declared, and their propagandists are making clear, that once Iran, quote, goes nuclear, unquote, it's too late. The American Conservative... A four-day war. This is in September 13th issue 2004 of the American Conservative by Claude Salhani. Four-day war. The Iran-Israel conflagration of history. A number of analysts have come to the conclusion that Iran will reach a critical stage in its pursuit of nuclear capability within the next few months. This is a terrifying new development, far more worrisome than the wars and uprisings that have plagued the Middle East to date. As Ray Takei, Director of Studies in the Near East and Southeast Center at the National Defense University, stated at a recent Washington conference, Iran has already passed the point of political no return in its bid for nuclear competence. Iran's urge to join the elite nuclear club has been sponsored and encouraged by patrons who want to see a second Islamic nation after Pakistan developing a nuclear weapon. And then it states, the Islamic Republic's objective has been that Iran will be recognized as a member of the nuclear club in an irreversible path. What is their four-day scenario? First, the United States invasion of Iraq served as a reminder to autocracies around the world of their need to be strong enough to deter U.S. intervention. The Iraq invasion served as the poster child for nuclear deterrence, which is driving Iraq's determination to be a nuclear power. Second, Iran cannot predict how a highly unstable Iraq will turn out. And so they say day one, Wednesday, in a pre-dawn raid, undisclosed numbers of Israeli warplanes taking off from military air bases in the Negev destroy Iran's main nuclear facility at Bushehr, Israel. Israel's armed forces have released no details, but the planes flew over parts of Jordan, northern Saudi Arabia, and Iraq, refueling in midair before reaching their target. Military analysts speculate that the planes refueled somewhere over Iraq with a U.S. collaboration. During the one-hour raid, Iran claims to have shot down Israeli fighters. Television images show pilots being lynched by furious mobs before Iranian authorities can reach them. Millions take to the streets, demanding immediate action against Israel across the Arab and Islamic world. In planning the attack, Israel weighed the threats of Arab and Muslim reaction. Israel considered striking Pakistan's nuclear strikes sites too, but held off for the moment. Believing, day two, Thursday, believing that Israel would never undertake these actions without U.S. Approval and collaboration and a nod from the American administration, Iran retaliates. Thousands of Revolutionary Guards are dispatched across the border to Iraq with orders to inflict as many casualties on American troops as possible. Fierce clashes erupt between coalition forces and Iranians. Within hours, over 400 U.S. troops are killed. Many more are wounded in heavy fighting. Iranian sleeper agents who have infiltrated Iraq since the downfall of Saddam urge a generalized uprising of Shiites throughout Iraq. Tehran now orders the Lebanese Shiite movement Hezbollah into action against northern Israel. Casualties are high on both sides as Israel retaliates. Tension in the Middle East reaches a boiling point. Massive demonstrations erupt all over the Arab and Islamic world. Crowds of gigantic proportions take to the streets, ransacking Israeli embassies in Cairo, Amman, and Ankara. American embassies in a number of cities are burned, with police overwhelmed, the military is called in, armies open fire, killing hundreds, adding to the outrage. Day 3, Friday. Following Friday prayers across the Islamic world, crowds, incited by fiery sermons in mosques from Casablanca to Karachi, take to the streets in the worst protest yet. Government buildings are ransacked, clashes with security forces result in great casualties, martial law is declared, curfew is imposed, but fails to prevent further mayhem and rioting. In Saudi Arabia, Islamic militants engage in open gun battles with security forces in several cities. The whereabouts of the Saudi royal family are unknown. In Indonesia, Malaysia, Egypt, and a dozen other countries, crowds continue to rise, demanding war in Israel. Day 4, Saturday. A long-standing plan to overthrow Musharraf is carried out by senior Pakistani army officials when the coup is carried out in utmost secrecy. Pakistan's intelligence services, a longtime supporter of the fundamentalists, takes control of the country's nuclear arsenal and its codes. Within hours and before news of the coup breaks out, Pakistan, now run by bin Laden fundamentalists, loads two nuclear weapons aboard an executive Learjet that take off from a remote military air force airfield, heads to Tel Aviv and Ashdod. Detouring and refueling in East Africa, they approach Israel from the south. The crafts identify themselves as South African. Their tail markings match the given identification. The planes with their deadly cargo are flown by suicide pilots armed with false flight plans and posing as business executives. They follow the flight path given to them by Israeli air control. The planes veer at the last moment, soar into the sky, and dive into the outskirts of Ashdod and Tel Aviv, detonating their nuclear devices in the process. Israel retaliates, killing millions in the process. Arab governments fall. Following days of violence, Syria, Jordan, and Egypt succumb to Islamic rebels, now in open warfare with Israel. The Middle East regresses into war. This article goes on, but this is a scenario that is clearly a scenario that is on the drawing boards in the Pentagon, in the intelligence services, and part of the inhibition about countenancing the direct attack and looking for a way to instigate an overthrow inside. But Maya, yes, please go ahead.
Well, I was going to mention what's been going on within Israel to support this scenario. This article by Salhani also mentions that Israel has built replicas of Iran's nuclear facilities in the Negev Desert in Israel, where their fighter bombers have been practicing test runs for months. And then if we look at DEPCA, which reveals Israeli intelligence information, DEPCA is promoting also the scenario that Iran is responsible not just for nuclear weapons, but for chemical warheads to be given to the Hezbollah force, which is supported by Iran, in Lebanon. DEPCA, July 26, 2004, reports, plans in the making in Tehran and Damascus envision a big future for Hezbollah in unconventional warfare. Military intelligence chief Major General Aaron Zeevi reported to the weekly cabinet meeting in Jerusalem Sunday, July 25th, that Syria is testing chemical warheads for Hezbollah's 115 and 215 kilometer range surface missiles, which are among the estimated 12,000 ranged along Lebanon's southern border with Israel. The warheads are manufactured by Syria, note this, with financing from Iran. And this is where the Israelis are promoting the role of Syria and Iran. As well, in Israel, the government has been distributing radiation sickness pills, anti-radiation pills, near the Dimona reactor. This started in August, and they've been distributing the tablets to 200,000 residents. The pills are an iodine compound that block absorption of radioactive material by shutting down the thyroid gland. Now, they had plans, they say, for years to distribute pills, but they didn't. So we take note that they're distributing these anti-radiation pills at the moment when they're revving up their language about attacking Iran.
Yes, Maya, there's no question about what the scenario is. Here's the BBC. U.S. turns the heat on Tehran with Iraq's government overthrown. Washington now sounds increasingly bellicose about Iran. That's the BBC of today's date. Lobbying hard for Tehran to be referred to the United Nations Security Council for breaking agreements to stop nuclear development. It's precisely the pattern of setting up the Iranians that was done with respect to Saddam Hussein in Iraq. The menace, the weapons of mass destruction, the prospect of a nuclear attack. And here is the response in the Wall Street Journal of Tehran. We will destroy Israel's reactor if we are attacked. Accompanied by a warning that its missiles have the range, Iran on Tuesday stated it will destroy Israel's Dimona nuclear reactor if the Jewish state attacks Iran's nuclear facilities. Quote, if Israel fires its missiles into the Bashir nuclear power plant, it can say goodbye to ever to its Dimona nuclear facility, where it produces and stockpiles hundreds, if not thousands, of nuclear weapons. The deputy chief of the Revolutionary Guards, Brigadier General Mohammed Bakir Zalkada, said in a statement. Iran says its nuclear program is strictly for generating electricity, but Israel and the United States state that Iran is secretly building nuclear weapons. And in regard to the distribution of anti-radiation pills, it's in the Wall Street Journal, Maya, and it's in direct response to the prospect of a missile exchange. And here says, backing up what you were saying a moment before with respect to Syria, September 2nd, 2004, Los Angeles Times, Israel to strike Syria over suicide bombings. Israel bluntly threatened to attack targets in Syria to retaliate against suicide bombings that killed 16 passengers and wounded dozens of others in Beersheba in a plan to overthrow the regime in Damascus.
Ralph, in an interview with Al Jazeera, the Iranian defense minister, Ali Shamkhani, remarked, quote, we will not sit with our arms folded waiting for others to act against us, putting forward a notion of preemptive attack by Iran. And this was in response to the comments by the Israelis. And they also announced that they had tested their medium-range missile, the Shabab 3, which is capable of reaching Israeli territory. As the minister said, all of Israeli territory, including its military installations and nuclear stocks, are now within reach of Iranian missiles and advanced technology. And is noted by Le Monde in an article, August 23rd, by Muna Naim, these statements by the Iranian defense minister wouldn't have been made if they didn't have the support of the Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. So we have here Israel and Iran responding to the clear signs from Israel, the clear signs that have been Israel has been making for years, but is now, as Iran is moving forward with its nuclear power plans, Israel is saying that it will not wait any longer.
Fox News on September 1st, the next administration must deal with Iran. Iran, a country that has bedeviled the United States for decades, will prove to be the biggest foreign policy challenge facing whoever is the next president. The messy Iraqi war and the spy scandal linking Pentagon and Israeli officials may complicate U.S. hopes of halting Iran's nuclear ambitions, but both President Bush and Democratic nominee John Kerry state they want to see that this nightmare scenario, a nuclear-armed, hostile Islamic State in the volatile Middle East, does not come to pass. Brothers and sisters, what we're dealing with here is a collusion between the one big property party with two names, the presumptive evil lesser of Kerry versus the evil axis of evil. Talk about an axis of evil between Bush and Kerry. You have really an axis of evil. As Mother Jones' article in February of 2004, The Lie Factory had it. We're being set up, brothers and sisters. We're being prepared for the next phase of permanent war. And you can be sure, as we've attempted to show, with the pretext of terrorism and false flag operations and the systemic lies about the regime in Tehran, no less than that in Baghdad, we're being set up for a grand escalation of the permanent war, which means repression at home. That is why we mobilize in a Million Worker March on October 17th with trade union federations across the country. We're at the point of production. We are going to have to resist this. This is a system in terminal decay and crisis. The established media may toy with us about nominal tactical divisions, but what is being prepared by this degenerate system is massive devastation. And it is we who must resist. We must take responsibility for building that movement of opposition. And it's October 17th that is the target date for the beginning of a fundamental movement of challenge to this decadent system.
You've been listening to Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, From Calamity to Conflagration, the Pending Attack on Iran. You can reach us at Taking Aim at PacBell, that's PACBELL.net, or Taking Aim at WBAI.org. You can call us at 707-552-9995 or write to us at P.O. Box 6345 Vallejo, California 94591. Our programs are archived on our website, www.takingaim.info. We look forward to hearing from you, and cassettes or audio CDs are available. We'll be with you next week.